This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, Lynn Malcolm with you for All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Today we explore the nature and secrets of the creative mind.
In Xanadu did Kubla Khan the stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round, and there were gardens bright with sinuous rills where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree. And here were forests ancient as the hills enfolding sunny spots of greenery.
A taste from the imagination of the romantic poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. His great poem Kubla Khan is sometimes seen as a metaphor conveying the turbulence which underlies the creative process. The concept of creativity has captured our imaginations for centuries. What's unique about the extraordinarily gifted minds of geniuses such as Coleridge, Michelangelo, or mathematician John Nash, physicist Stephen Hawking, and what allowed them to soar to such creative heights? Today, Professor Nancy Andreasen takes us on an intriguing tour of the imaginative mind, which is documented in her recent book, The Creating Brain, The Neuroscience of Genius. She's one of the world's leading psychiatrists in the field of schizophrenia, and she's based at Iowa University in the United States. She's pioneered some of the brain imaging techniques used in modern psychiatry. But interestingly, Nancy Andreasen's career began as Professor of English Renaissance Literature, which explains her fascination with the creative breakthroughs during this period of history. So let's try and get a handle on what makes a person creative. To begin with, Nancy Andreasen emphasises that creativity is different and separate to intelligence.
Being creative is one kind of trait, and being highly intelligent is another kind of trait. There are many people who are highly intelligent who are not at all creative. I think that pertains to many doctors, many lawyers. I'm a doctor myself. I'm not meaning to insult doctors at all. Many people in business are intelligent but not creative. Of course, some people in these professions are creative, too. Then, on the other hand, take creative people. The mean IQ of the average creative writer, and that's a study that I've done, is 120. Now, that's not a genius-level IQ. It's a high normal or low, highly intelligent IQ. But I got that figure studying well-known American writers whom I studied in a variety of ways, including IQ testing. That finding has been replicated at least two or three other times, showing that people who are creative tend to have, yes, a decent IQ, but not typically in the 150s or 160s, which is what most people consider a high IQ.
You've also outlined studies that have looked at personality characteristics of highly creative people. Can you just give us a picture of the types of characteristics that people have?
Sure. Again, a number of psychologists have done personality testing on creative people. And if they haven't done personality testing, they've done personal interviews where they've been able to define their personality styles just based on behavior. In my own study of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, I, in fact, did both. And what emerges from these various methods is that creative people tend to be very curious about all kinds of things. They tend to be adventuresome. They tend to be a little bit iconoclastic, which is related to being original, of course. Sometimes they just perceive things in a totally new and different way that other people are simply not able to see? I mean, they see things that are true and real and yet and that are obvious to them. That's especially true in science and math. And they aren't obvious to other people. Some of the creative scientists I know will say over and over, isn't that obvious? Isn't that obvious? It's just obvious. Doesn't everybody know that? That's obvious. They are sometimes a little prone to get into trouble because they're original and seem rebellious. And especially you could get into trouble when you're a younger person. You may be unpopular with your teachers because you might seem like a know-it-all. You may be unpopular with your peers for the same reason. And so some people who are creative have somewhat miserable childhoods. And I think it's one of the challenges of our society, of all societies, to figure out how to actually recognize and nurture these original kids rather than and essentially sometimes punishing them for their originality. Another characteristic is that they tend to be obsessional, not in a diseased way, but they start to chew on a problem. And that might be writing a story. It might be a math problem. It might be a computer science problem. It might be creating a painting. And they get into it so deeply that they may end up working all night on what they're doing. Michelangelo is a wonderful example because he worked, 16, 20 hours a day when he was working on something, which was nearly his entire life. And when he was an older man, he had such an intense drive to continue creating that he rigged up an apparatus that he wore on his head that consisted of candles so that he could wield his hammer and chisel all night long creating statues.
Nancy Andreasen's study of creativity included detailed interviews with a range of artists about their experience of the creative process, including the prolific American playwright Neil Simon. He has a special genius for finding great humour in our everyday lives. Here's an example from his award-winning work, The Odd Couple.
Can we just play cards?
I told you you'd get into trouble. It's because you don't know how to manage anything. I should know. I'm your accountant.
If you're my accountant, how come I need money?
If you need money, how come you play poker?
Because I need money.
But you always lose.
That's why I need the money.
Then don't play poker.
Then don't come to my house and eat my potato chips. You see?
He owes money to his wife, his government, his friends, and he still won't take it seriously.
Life goes on even for those of us who are divorced, broke, and slappy. You know, divorced, broke, and slappy. Hello, sweetheart.
The comic masters Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon in The Odd Couple by Neil Simon, who shared some of his insights with Nancy Andreasen.
Well, what I learned from him is really very similar to what many, many creative people describe about their creative process. He said things like, I don't write consciously. It's as if the muse just sits on my shoulder. I sit at the typewriter or pick up my pen and the words just come flowing out. And I don't know what I'm going to say until I start saying it. And I don't even know what the ending of a play is going to be until I've written the last lines. He said if I did know, I might tip the audience off and the play would be much less interesting and exciting. He said things like, I slip into a state that is separate from reality. I go into almost a trance-like state. He described what a psychiatrist would call a kind of dissociative state or a dreamlike state where the original ideas occur to him. A very interesting thing that he said was that he's always kind of felt as if he's invisible. He's a spectator watching other people. And I thought that was particularly interesting because here he is, a playwright, and he has to figure out how other people are going to think and talk and act and so on. And as a playwright, he's on the sidelines watching in his mind the characters that he's creating. That sense of being almost invisible is another thing that a lot of creative people have. They are ghosts that spy on the universe, to borrow a line from Shakespeare, and they are often very humble, unassuming people, despite the fact that they are also adventuresome and original and so on.
But oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a cedarn cover, a savage place, as holy and enchanted as e'er beneath a waning moon was haunted by woman wailing for her demon lover. And from this
from Kubla Khan by the romantic poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Nancy Andreasen sees this poem as an archetypal example of the creative process.
The story of how he came to write Kubla Khan is a very famous story if you happen to be an English lit major. Coleridge was in his early 20s and just beginning his career as a poet. He was in chronic ill health, and he went out to the countryside, and he took an anodyne, probably an opiate, to make himself feel better. He was reading a book called Pilgrimages by Samuel Purchas, and while reading this book, he fell into a sleep, a dream, a reverie, as he says, if it can be called a dream, in which ideas and words came before my mind in clouds. And so in this state of reverie, he composed a poem that was about 200 to 300 lines long, and then he woke up and he started writing it down. And after he'd gotten about 50 or so lines written down, somebody knocked on the door, and he went and answered it and had to go run an errand. And when he got back, he couldn't remember those 200 to 300 lines. And so all we have is this fragment.
5 miles meandering with a mazy motion through wood and dale the sacred river ran, then reached the caverns measureless to man and sank in tumult to a lifeless ocean. And mid this tumult, Kubla heard from far ancestral voices prophesying war.
Do creative people actually think differently to people who aren't highly creative?
At least sometimes, yes. There's a very famous example of Richard Feynman, the physicist. And he's, again, kind of an archetypal example for many creative people in math, physics. And it would be almost legendary that somebody could give him a very difficult problem, write it on the blackboard, and then he'd stand there, put his hands on his forehead and think for maybe 5 minutes. Then he'd write out the answer. And it would be a long way from the problem to the answer. And he would have no idea how he got there. It was just sheer intuition. And it might take 2 weeks to figure out all the equations that went in between the first one and the last one, or the first one and the solution. And that capacity to see what other people can't see is one of the hallmarks of creative people, to just go on sheer intuition and know something.
You were part of the revolution, really, in the concept of imaging the brain using latest technology. What have we been able to tell about the creative brain with new brain imaging technologies? Is there something different that we can see?
Well, the imaging revolution has been around for, approximately 15 years. It really got into full gear maybe 5 to 8 years ago. There has not been a lot of research done using imaging technology to study the creative brain. Especially there hasn't been much functional imaging, or in other words, studies of brain physiology, either during the creative process or during some proxy of the creative process. I did one of the few studies that might illuminate that process, which was to look at a state which I called random episodic silent thought. This is a little bit of a joke, because when functional imaging first got started, the design always has to be to have an experimental condition and then a control or comparison condition. And the experimental condition might be remembering a list of words if it's a study of memory. And then the control condition is supposed to be something neutral compared to that experimental condition. And in the early days of PET scanning, or even now in functional MR imaging, people are told, well, just rest. Don't think about anything in particular. And so you'd have these studies where they were remembering words or resting, remembering stories or resting, reading words on the screen versus resting. And I kept saying to everybody, look, there's no such thing as rest. The brain never rests. When people are sitting there for 5 minutes just, quote, resting, they're actually thinking about things. And I'll bet if we did a study and debriefed them afterward, we'd find out that they were thinking about what we call technically episodic memory, or remembering things from the past, or thinking about things that are going to happen in the future, which is a form of episodic memory, and thinking in a very free associating way, in fact. So we did that study, and what we found from the debriefing was, indeed, that they were thinking in a very free-floating way that's kind of analogous to what is characterized as free association in psychoanalytic thinking. And what we observed during rest was that the parts of the brain that are active during rest are the parts that we call the association cortex. The association cortex has no specific function. It's part of the brain, and you know, we have about 4 association cortices in our brains spotted around in different locations. They're the parts of the brain that make connections with other parts of the brain. So my theory is that during the creative process, which derives from these kind of unconscious states that we go into when we free associate or when our brain, quote, rests, during that, ideas are floating around, colliding, making connections. Sometimes the connections are not very important or trivial, but sometimes they're original. And people who have especially well-developed association cortices are likely to be more creative. That's the working theory. And I'm just embarking on a study right now of highly creative people using functional imaging and using tasks or conditions where I can study the way their association cortex works. I mean, I'm giving them tasks that will stimulate their creativity and then see if indeed that draws on their association cortex. It's actually one of the more fun studies I've done.
You're with All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and via podcast. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and I'm speaking with Professor Nancy Andreasen about creativity and the human brain.
Despite my privileged upbringing, I'm actually quite well balanced. I have a chip on both shoulders.
Maybe you're just better with the old integers than you are with people.
My first grade teacher, she told me that I was born with 2 helpings of brain, but only half a helping of heart.
Wow, she sounds lovely.
But the truth is that I don't like people much, and they don't much like me.
But why? With all your obvious wit and charm.
Hey, Nash, I thought you dropped out. You ever going to go to class?
Classes will dull your mind. Destroy the potential for authentic creativity.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Nash is going to stun us all with his genius.
You scared?
Terrified. Mortified. Petrified. Stupefied by you. No starch. Pressed and folded.
Russell Crowe, in the film A Beautiful Mind, which depicts the life of mathematical genius and Nobel Prize winner John Nash and his struggle with schizophrenia. There are many examples in films and literature of highly gifted people having a mental illness. The idea of the troubled artists has almost become a stereotype. But is there a measurable link between genius and insanity? Nancy Andreasen.
Well, I guess the first thing that one wants to say is that it's a little bit like the relationship between intelligence and creativity. Just as not all intelligent people are creative and not all creative people are intelligent, so too, not all creative people have mental illness, and certainly not all people who have mental illness are creative. So the notion that great genius is to madness near allied and thin partitions do its bounds divide, to quote Dryden, that has been around at least since Aristotle. So lots of people have believed that people with genius are a little odd, a little weird, have a mental illness. There were a series of scientific or pseudoscientific studies that began to be done in the early 20th century, most of them not very well designed and most of them relying heavily on anecdote. I did really the first careful empirical study of creativity and mental illness, looking at a sample of writers from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, Iowa, where my medical school is based and where I was a professor in the English department. Iowa has the most famous creative writing program in the U.S. and also the first. And almost every major American writer has at one time or another been on the faculty or been a student at the Writers' Workshop. So I used 30 of those people as my sample and then 30 people who were not known to me to be creative, social workers, hospital administrators, a variety of people. And interestingly, IQ tested both groups. each group had a mean IQ of 120. Bingo again. Perfectly matched. I did match them on education, and it turned out they were matched on IQ.
When Nancy Andreasen interviewed the creative group, she found something quite surprising.
What I discovered was that 75-80% of them, in fact, had a history of mood disorder. Some of them manic depressive, that is, with highs and lows. Some of them just depressed. But an astonishing amount of mood disorder. I mean, I was just amazed, just absolutely amazed. And it turned out that their first-degree relatives had a much higher rate of mood disorder than the control group, and their first-degree relatives had a much higher rate of creativity. So in that study, which has been now replicated a number of times, it appeared that the link was between having mood disorder or depression and creativity. At the time I did that study, I said to myself, I wonder what would happen if I studied somebody, another group, like scientists or mathematicians. Because when I designed the study, I did it really expecting to find essentially normality in the writers, but schizophrenia in their first-degree relatives. And that was my hypothesis because I'd been a great student of Joyce, who had a daughter with schizophrenia, and himself was kind of schizotypal. Einstein had a son with schizophrenia. I knew Bertrand Russell had several family members with schizophrenia. And now, looking back on those people, I'm thinking, well, maybe there's also a connection between creativity and schizophrenia, but I should have looked into math and physics primarily, and there I might be more likely to see a connection between schizophrenia and creativity. Another interesting thing that I observed in the workshop study was that the creativity that ran in families was varied. It wasn't as if all their relatives were also writers. Instead, a creative person might have a daughter who was a painter, a sister who was a dancer, an uncle who was a famous inventor. So it gave me the sense that creativity itself is more a way of approaching the world, a typical kind of thought process, and perhaps a typical kind of personality as well.
Which I guess brings us to the nature versus nurture argument, the heritability of creativity versus the experience of people in their lives.
Well, the role of nature and nurture in creativity, I think, is probably one of the most fascinating and most basic questions that one can ask. On the one hand, it does seem that being creative does, to some extent, run in families. And so it must be partly heritable. But on the other hand, there are people, many, many people, who are highly creative who don't have any family history of creativity. In my book, I talk about the two great geniuses of the Renaissance, Leonardo and Michelangelo. Neither of them came from creative backgrounds. Both came from relatively humble backgrounds. And how did it happen that two of the greatest creators from all time came out from nowhere and produced the Mona Lisa, the Last Supper, David, all the Pietas that Michelangelo did, the Sistine Ceiling, the Last Judgment? You know, what made that happen? There must have been something in their nature, and what was in their nature must have been some of these traits that I'm talking about, like curiosity and persistence and ability to see things in a novel way. But they also needed nurture. And they happened to be lucky enough to be born in the Renaissance, and Michelangelo to be practically adopted by the Medici family. And then through those connections, he obtained connections with popes who commissioned him to do various things and so on. So there was a great deal of environmental influence in both of those people. And it's an important question because one wonders how many lost geniuses there are.
So now, with our latest knowledge about the brain and its plasticity, its ability to change and reform, can we build better brains?
Well, again, this is one of the most fundamental and important questions we can ask. a lot of people think that creativity is something that you do, say, between 20 and 40 or 50. And a lot of people think that creativity is limited to these highly creative people that we've been talking about. But in fact, all of us have the capacity to be creative. Life is not over at 50. People in their 50s, 60s, and 70s can do things to exercise their brains that will both make them stronger intellectually, but also make them more creative. Can be things as simple as a cooking club or a book club or a wine tasting club, or more complex as a problem-solving club or an adventure club or whatever. In other words, it's never too late to do something in an interesting, fun, and original way. And looking at the other end of the spectrum, looking at kids, I think one of the most important questions that we have to think about as a society, that is a human society linked throughout the world, is how can we help our young children be more creative? How can we educate our kids in the regular educational system so that they can realize as much of their creative potential as possible? And how can they be stimulated outside the school system to be creative? And all those things that we potentially do, as you've suggested, create changes in our plastic brains. Plastic, of course, meaning continually remodeled and adaptable. This is something we need to be thinking about. We need to be studying more. And we need to ultimately learn more about how to achieve that.
Mm. On an individual level, but also as a society, how do we create a more creative society?
Yes, very important question. At the social level, you know, there's some general things. One example is that in the school curriculums, what can we do? You know, I think a big question is how much tracking should be done. A lot of school systems, people get on a track very early and they stay on that track and really they can't get off. And it's a narrow track. You know, by the time you're 16 or so, you've got to decide whether you're going to do medicine or you're going to do literature or classics or political science or whatever. I think that's a mistake. You know, I think the more people can learn about multiple topics, the richer their brains are going to be, and then the greater their opportunity to see things in original and creative ways.
Could I revive within me her symphony and song, to such a deep delight 'twould win me that with music loud and long I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware his flashing eyes, his floating hair. Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise.
The poem Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge was read by Michael Sheen. And you've been listening to Nancy Andreasen, Professor of Psychiatry at Iowa University. Her most recent book, The Creating Brain, The Neuroscience of Genius, is published by Dana Press and distributed in Australia by Footprint Books. Thanks today to Pauline Newman and to sound engineer Jenny Parsonage. To visit All in the Mind's website, go to abc.net.au/rn, where you'll find further information and the audio for the last four programs, which you can download onto your MP3 player. I'm Lynne Malcolm, and do join me next week for All in the Mind to continue our exploration of creativity. We'll meet a remarkable man whose art is an act of necessity in his struggle with mental illness. But stay with ABC Radio National for The Philosopher's Zone. Alan Saunders' guest today is Arthur Danto, and they'll be discussing the notion of art and how we know it when we see it. Bye for now.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.